Pleasure to be here and to support Glenn and his Science Communication Institute. Glenn is a member of our staff at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, valued member for a number of years, and sprung off of this initiative, and it's nice to see it going well. I should begin with some disclaimer, because I don't work in communications research at all. I have quite a few years of experience of working with journals and communicating our research of various types, and so I stand before you as an exhibit A of some successes, some failures, some instances where we've, with help from journals, have communicated successfully, but others where maybe we got bullied a little bit and still don't feel like we got the main message out there. So I started to think about this talk a couple of weeks ago. I was returning from some lectures I was giving in New York City, Memorial Sloan Kettering, and sitting on an airplane. Usually you don't use your time very efficiently on an airplane, but I happened to have my curriculum vitae accessible, so I thought I'll do a little frequency distribution of my own publications in journals since 2002. I don't think it'll interest you that much, but it was interesting for me. But it'll use like kind of a springboard for some of the interactions that relate to the National Women's Health Initiative, which we have coordinated at the Hutchinson Center since its inception in 1992, particularly in relation to communications related to the health risks and benefits of postmenopausal hormone therapy, which generated a lot of interest, as well as a low-fat eating pattern. And I will end with just a few observations or axes to grind and some of the time trends that I've seen in interactions with journals. So my own career, as Glenn mentioned, I'm a mathematician, biostatistician, and that's where I published initially, but I became interested in the methodology of population science research, of disease patterns, of risk factors for disease, got into epidemiology early on. I was teaching at a Canadian university around Canada at that time. When the Hutchinson Center was just getting started, I moved here in 1974. There wasn't much of a Hutchinson Center at that time. But Don Thomas and his group, who had pioneered bone marrow transplantation, were in place, and I had the pleasure of working with them for a few years. Got involved in some of the key findings about what works well and what doesn't for bone marrow transplant recipients and the problems that they might encounter, like graft-versus-host disease. And somewhere around the early 1980s, we became a separate division of Public Health Sciences, and it's now a large division of 800 to 900 staff members. And I became impressed with the lack of quantitatively trained people in the disease prevention population science area. And I sort of deliberately said goodbye to my friends in the therapeutic side, said I'm going to devote myself to trying to do something in the population science area. So that included becoming involved in trying to foster a large intervention trial of a low-fat eating pattern that was a National Cancer Institute opportunity. Actually, I first looked for somebody else to do the coordination, couldn't find anybody, so I did it myself or tried. And that had periods of ups and downs with lots of variable input from senior committees, which I won't bore you with. But we were still alive, but likely to fail until Bernadine Healy came in as the first woman director of the National Institutes of Health and read our 1,000-page proposal for a large long-term trial that got a fundable score, but the National Cancer Institute was finding a way to push it aside, and Bernadine was impressed by it, as well as some long history on the hormone therapy side, where there was a lot of observational data, mostly of benefits, heart disease benefits, Women's Health Initiative got kicked off the national program. 161,000 postmenopausal women around the country. The IOM, Institute of Medicine, was asked to do a review, and the knock on the hormonal therapy trials was the benefits, heart disease benefits, were so well established, you don't need to do a trial. Spend your money some other way. So bottom line, turned out to be there wasn't heart disease benefit, there was an early adverse effect, and it wasn't clear there was a benefit period, and there's a more complicated pattern of risk and benefits, which I will outline briefly. The low-fat diet intervention involvement impressed upon me that we had gurus in the area who were very influential, and they thought, well, we already know that a low-fat diet doesn't matter for breast cancer prevention or any other cancer, or maybe a certain type of low-fat diet might make a difference for cardiovascular disease. And I studied their methodology and research as well as I could and didn't find it convincing. And what we've been doing, mostly colleagues related to this Women's Health Initiative for the last decade or so, is trying to introduce objective measures of dietary consumption into the research agenda, improving the methodology. There's some aspects of diet, like total energy consumption, that can be assessed accurately, at least on the short term, using what's called the doubly labeled water technique, and urinary nitrogen for protein consumption, weight stable women, and so on. So that's a big interest of mine now, is nutrition and chronic disease, also physical activity and chronic disease. Overall, I would say this is a research area that's of great interest to our general populace. They grab onto just about any report that gets in the literature, but those reports are often very confusing and mutually contradictory, and often not convincing to me as a reader. I don't know what to make of it. I think it's substantially uninterpretable, even though important. And the last topic I listed here is genomics and proteomics and other omics, which I had also gotten into a little bit. But I actually have a little reluctance there in terms of how much our well-trained young people are moving into those areas of high-dimensional data or big data, maybe at the expense of some of the more important common exposures like nutrition and physical activity that I've mentioned that are key to the obesity epidemic and the other reasons that we have phenomenally high rates in this country and in Western countries for coronary heart disease and breast cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, and so on. So these kind of have to be balanced, and there's a big temptation for young people to go into an area because there's funding, and temptation for others not to go into some areas because it's difficult, and it's not clear that we it adds up to the research strategy or plan for population science and disease prevention that's really needed. So I'm talking long-winded today here, I realize. But this research I've been engaged in, about half of it with the investigator-initiated research, mainly methodologic research, and half collaborative with multidisciplinary collaborators. The journals that are used differ accordingly. About half is methodology, half application. Frequently, especially in the methodology side, the target audience is the researchers who work in the same arenas, or maybe somewhat broader research community. But some of the applications that have potential to impact public health and FDA guidance, recommendations for diet, physical activity, for example. It's a broader audience that we're ultimately aiming for. There's the disease prevention versus disease treatment dichotomy, and there are sometimes some implications for policy, which I know some of you are expert in. I find it very important, but not expert. So this is what I did on the airplane. I listed my own involvement in publications in the last few years, and not trying to impress you, but just on the left we have the areas where I was trained. So we looked down those journals, some of them have a great reputation, Jim have in the medical and clinical areas. So this is where we've published a lot of our work from the Women's Health Initiative. And you look down this list and you see great variations in internal impact and quality and reliability. So should pick out any exhibit A's as poor, but if somebody publishes something on hormone therapy in menopause versus JAMA or New England Journal, well, the latter will have a high level of believability and reliability. The press will be involved in the rollout, and you'll read about it in the newspaper. But if it's here, you don't make much make of these items. So I became interested in nutrition, as I mentioned. A lot of that's published over here, but nutritional journals have their own features. And sometimes they don't like having statistical types come in and rock the boat too much. That was also the case in epidemiology if you go back 30 years. It's changed somewhat. It's better integrated now. It hasn't happened so much over here. Important public health topics, and then do publish in the genomics and translation of research. Nature Genetics is a high level publication for new findings related to genetics and chronic disease, which kinds of data that started to become available 10 years ago, which made able to interrogate the genome in a couple million places and look for associations. It's a lot of press, but in my view, it's as useful, but it really hasn't added up to much that impacts public health or disease risk assessment. In most cases, if you look at the risk factors that are already known for a given disease, how much have the 20 or 30 SNPs that have been identified subsequently added to the ability to predict who will get disease? Not very much, maybe for type 2 diabetes, but really hasn't had much impact, even though it's great hits that are celebrated. But that doesn't mean that it's not useful. That these 20 or 30 leads more for some diseases do give some basis for research into the pathways that might be unrecognized that are relevant to carcinogenesis or cardiology or other areas, and lots of those are being pursued. So I've probably said this already, there's a very wide variety of journals. I learned from looking at one of your displays that it's like 30,000. Scientists need journals. So, adage, research unpublished is equivalent to research that hasn't been done. And publication in respected journals is key to career progress. Even for old guys, you need to have a continued documented success in getting publications that have some impact, and that's usually judged by the reputation of the journals involved, younger people getting promoted and so on. So we're very much academic research community, very much tied into the journal publication process. The journal status within disciplines is well known by researchers. And even though the number of journals goes up exponentially according to that math over there, mathematicians are always interested in this modeling efforts, but very close to exponential growth rate in the number of journals, but at least someone sitting in my position that hasn't had too much impact means that you can publish just about anything somewhere if you are willing to drive long and hard enough. But in terms of publications that are respected and help you in your career, or more importantly, might help public who we want to serve, or the patients who might be served, then there's key journals that are holding court, and they work very hard to hold their position. So major medical journals have a substantial role in determining the message that medical practitioners and the general public receive. Reliable reports in scientific journals really help to offset what I call cacophony here when there becomes large business implications. There's lots of people that rise to the surface when their pocketbook is threatened. And we had, I think, some fairly extreme examples of that in the rollout of some of the results from the Women's Health Initiative, which I will just expand on a little bit now. 21,808 women. 27,000 were in two hormone therapy trials. These all started in 1993, and enrollment took place over 5 years. The DM, the low-fat dietary trial, 48,000, and then at 1 year of anniversary, the women could be further randomized to a calcium and vitamin D supplementation trial, which I won't talk about today. Also interesting. Oops, better go the right direction. So as I mentioned, we had some life in this trying to get a very large research project, and in my view, the public health population science area needs larger research projects as part of its research agenda. These are kind of like the core on which a lot of other research can build, and that should include, in my view, randomized controlled trials, as logistically difficult and expensive as they might be from time to time. So we were greatly facilitated by Bernadine Healy, the late Bernadine Healy, coming in, as I mentioned, the first NI director, and announced Congress to appropriate $500 million, which was later supplemented by Claude L'Enfant, the director of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, to conduct the Women's Health Initiative. It took place at 40 clinical centers, sponsored initially by the NI's director office, but moved to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, where there was better infrastructure. And we were going along kind of nicely, lots of logistics, until our external data safety monitoring committee said, we've seen enough. We think the health risks exceed benefits for estrogen plus progestin therapy, which was used by about 6 million women in the US. The estrogen alone therapy that we studied was used by about 8 million women in the US, primarily for the control of menopausal symptoms. But over time, the reputation grew that these preparations had a lot of other reported benefits, like about a 40 to 50% reduction in coronary heart disease risk and reduction in dementia and so on. That's what was reported based on observational data. So when we came out with our first clinical trial report in JAMA in 2002 on the estrogen plus progestin trial, with results that were quite different from beliefs going in, we went in hoping to see a major reduction in heart disease as well, but we saw 30% increase shown in offline here. Probably can't read that, 1.29 hazard ratio, so-called, nominally significant. We saw an increase in breast cancer risk, which wasn't such a surprise. It was actually a little smaller than we expected. Increase in stroke and venous thromboembolism, including pulmonary embolism. But we did see some reductions in fractures, maybe colorectal cancer. And we specified in our monitoring plan a global index, which was the time to the earliest of any of these events up above it, and it was in the unfavorable direction for estrogen plus progestin. So this caused a lot of consternation. We had a lot of enemies all of a sudden, and a lot of people wondering if we'd made some terrible mistake. And I could spend more time than I have describing a lot of the implications that followed, but it was a great value to have published in JAMA, which has a strong reputation for its review process. And I must say the Food and Drug Administration and regulatory agencies in the UK and elsewhere in the world use these data very effectively, and we're not influenced, it didn't seem, by many people that claimed that something was wrong. And JAMA, in this case, they sent teams to interview some of our key people as part of the media coverage of these trial results. So there, the pharmaceutical company involved, which of course was greatly impacted, a multi-billion dollar a year product that's now in question, so there's a big risk for Big Pharma in putting their products that developed for another purpose on such this kind of test. Why theirs subsequently was sued by many women for mainly for breast cancer, and eventually they ceased to exist. They're bought out by Pfizer, but the product on the left, Premgro, estrogen plus progestin. About 70% of the women who are using in the country stopped right away. And even Premarin on the right-hand side, which we reported on a couple of years later, had a more balanced benefit versus risk profile. But it didn't show the heart disease benefit either. So even Premarin, if we hadn't reported on that, about 40% of women stopped using it then. Also, more after the results of the estrogen trial were available. And I guess in terms of my own career, in terms of public health impact, I think 200 colleagues around the country, what we're most pleased about is when you look at the rate of breast cancer among women in the country, it's going along about 200,000 women per year newly diagnosed, and that dropped by about 10%, and in the immediately postmenopausal period, dropped by considerably more than that. Many countries around the world that were using these types of preparations also saw that same reduction. So we estimate 15,000 to 20,000 women in the U.S. alone per year are not getting the breast cancer diagnosis that would be the case if the patterns of using estrogen plus progestin had continued. So the low-fat eating pattern, do I have like 5 minutes, when, or should I stop? Yeah. Has a different history. The observational data, epidemiologic data, were mixed on the topic, with international correlation being supportive of a low-fat eating pattern. Case control studies that used a variety of dietary assessment tools, some positive, that is higher risk with a high-fat diet, but cohort studies that are usually taken to be the strongest of the observational studies were not showing support. But we had this trial underway as part of the Women's Health Initiative with the goals shown on the left, mainly reduction in the fat content of the diet from its kind of typical 35% of energy of calories to 20% of energy when some of these results came forward. But this was controversial, and unfortunately the results weren't so clear. But breast cancer and colorectal cancer were the designated primary outcomes, and for breast cancer, where we had 1,700 cases during follow-up period through 2005, there was a 9% reduction in incidence, but not quite statistically significant. Actually, this 9% reduction was about 70% of what we hypothesized at trial design, and the women achieved about 70% of the adherence to the low-fat eating pattern that we hypothesized. So in that sense, this was about as consistent with expectation as it could be, but it wasn't statistically significant. Journals like JAMA, where we published again, need to have firm standards, and in this case, the journal editor basically made us write. It wasn't quite the way we wrote the first draft. The intervention, the low-fat diet intervention, was not effective in reducing breast cancer. And media had a lot of fun with that. Again, the pundits and made fun of the government, told us we should eat this way, now we really know. So it's, for me, it's having worked on this topic since the mid-1980s, unsatisfying that we haven't succeeded in getting a more accurate picture out of the potential for a breast cancer reduction. There were some investigators not affiliated with the Women's Health Initiative that reported that if this intervention were implemented in the U.S., it would reduce breast cancer by 10,000 additional women per year. And there were some interesting results for ovarian cancer with many fewer cases as well. So we're continuing to follow these women, and we'll report further on this topic. But here's a case where I think exhibit A is failure to communicate an adequate message on a topic of considerable interest. And of course, there are many, many other important diet and disease, chronic disease questions that we can't do very many of these large-scale clinical trials, and we need to rely on observational studies, but we need to have studies that are stronger than the ones that have been published with great growth. recent years, and we think these objective markers, biomarkers of consumption, are a way to go. And in fact, it's strange that statistically trained people have to be taking the lead in this, but we sort of are currently conducting a sizable feeding study at our facility in the Hutchison Center. We've got 150 women in Seattle area, part of the Women's Health Initiative, to try to identify suitable biomarkers for other components of diet, mainly through blood and urine measures, along with such subject characteristics. I'm getting rather far afield. Well, this was just to say the breast cancer and ovarian cancer data had a little more substance than my previous slide showed. The hazard ratio did relate significantly to the fat content at the beginning of women's diet before they were randomized to either low fat diet or control. Women that started high in fat made a bigger change and had stronger evidence for breast cancer reduction. Very similar for ovarian cancer. So this is my last slide then. It's just a summary of a few changes that I've observed. There's clearly proliferation of journals and communication outlets that are likely quite important in relation to the general public. They don't seem to me to have that much impact on how research scientists behave. There's opportunities, if you're willing to pay, for open access, which is quite valuable as a scientist trying to get up to speed in a new area quickly. Expectation that data will be made available to get your research grants at NIH. You have to assert that you will make reasonable efforts to do so. In the Women's Health Initiative, we had rather complicated processes for making data available to other investigators, which I wouldn't do if I hadn't talked too long. Lots of changes over time in what journals impose on authors. Many disclosures, somebody misused the process somewhere, and now we all pay the lowest common denominator price. There are word count restrictions that you have to fit into, which are often awkward. And something that's a little bit of a peeve for me, but some of you probably have a much better framework. I'm sure it's not easy to economics of putting out a journal is probably difficult, but author page charges just seem fundamentally wrong to me. And we often have to sign something saying, because we're making a payment, this has to be declared as advertising. So that it's not advertising, this is the randomized controlled trials done the best way human beings know how to do them. Why should we have to label our research in that? It doesn't really impact anything, but it's an annoyance. So there's a way that journals could avoid the page charge thing that seemed to come in about 20 years ago. Another phenomenon is high dimensional authorship. They got all these genetic association studies, for example, and they're meta-analysis because the effects are so weak. The hazard ratio increased to 5%, and you can tell it's a little bit bigger than zero. But well, these together, you need tens of thousands of people that have been studied by various groups, so you end up with like 100 authors. And what does authorship mean in that case? I have to say I'm a little jaded, but when I'm a participant there sometimes too, but see somebody that's a 33rd author, I tend to not count it against them rather than positive for their research record. Like to see people that have their own ideas and can pursue them. An obligation to be part of collaborative research as well, but if you see talented young people that are devoting most of their energies to these big data operations where you really don't need 100 scientists, you only need 5, and that's not a good way of using our national intellectual resources. So it's kind of authorship evaluation. I'll stop there.
Interaction between scientists and journals.
think probably there's a greater recognition of the status of the journal on the author's part that dictates, and we try pretty hard to get material in the journal that's well recognized and might have an impact. That, at least to me, that wasn't so obvious 30 years ago. Get it published or it's available to whoever wants it, that should be good enough. But it's, so that's, I think it's a meaningful change and goes back to the reliability of the information. Even though we think we're all objective scientists, people have their legacy views, and especially those who might have benefited from some funding source in the past, they might go to great lengths to support their views. So you have to really scrutinize the quality, and that's why we have to fill out the disclosures, the recent or ongoing interactions. Are you speaking in a certain forum, advocating for things? We have to disclose those. I think it's all good. It's, but actually, when you add it on to what NIH might require in terms of grantees, the danger is that we spend, research scientists spend too much of their time and their staff time just meeting a lot of requirements at the expense of not applying themselves very well. And you add to that a typical scientist in academia who has to be on a lot of committees and teach classes and so on, it comes down to a pretty small segment of time where they can really think and be innovative. So we have to watch it all. A lot of the pressure that comes from our own organizations often, more and more bureaucratic, certainly federal interactions, more so than journal interactions, it can stymie what we're really trying to do to serve the public. So that's a worry. And it is a change. That's a big change. Yeah.
So you mentioned the concern about page charges, and I'm just curious how you feel about shifting to open access, where in fact there's going to be much larger charges to authors. So it's a big trade-off between the public availability and increased charge to authors, which in some cases is okay because there are grants a lot for it, but not in every case.
So. Yeah, so even though I got little devices in my ears, I'm not sure I heard you fully, but it's really charges that go with open access?
Well, so, right, so there's trade-offs between open access, and one of those big costs is that authors are going to have to pay quite a bit to publish, and it varies a lot, but it can be significant. So what are your thoughts about that trade-off?
I mean, I can't say I thought a lot about it. I find it kind of fundamentally objectionable to have to pay for open access. I like the concept of open access. I like to be able to access myself, especially if I'm trying to get up to speed in a new area quickly. And you know, it doesn't pose any insurmountable problem in our research context to have to pay these charges, but it really seems like I'd like to hear whether there's a better way. And then I think it is a limitation for researchers who might not be in as established settings. Come up with a few $1,000s to first have your paper come out, and maybe another few thousand to have it readily available. And if it's readily available, then we got to get a lot more attention than it is open access. So it's probably something that a group like this, your institute, could recommend on a valuable patent. I'd rather streamline both cases.
Thank you very much for coming. It's really important to have this foundational perspective before we move forward today, to understand that that journals play a vital role in science, in public understanding of science, and in the advancement of science. So before we start to dissect how to improve journals moving forward, we need to make sure that that's the foundation of our research.